Jotcast, February 2026 edition. This is Sohini, and joining me in the studio is Phoebe. This month, we have an interview with Professor Jonathan Tennyson, where he chats to Louisa and Lily about his founding of the satellite launching company Blue Sky Space. And in our Jot Byte, Louise and Josh talk to postdoc Will McGann about his work here at the Advanced Radio Instrumentation Group. In December, we also had an invite to attend RAL Space's 21st Appleton Conference, where Louisa and Phoebe chatted to some of the conference attendees. But first, the news.
The launch window for NASA's Artemis Mission 2 has opened. NASA's Artemis 2 moon rocket has been moved to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral ahead of its launch, which could happen later this month, and is planned to launch no later than April this year. This is the first crewed mission to return to our moon since the end of the Apollo program in 1972, and follows on from the Artemis 1 rocket, which was an uncrewed mission launched back in 2020. The Artemis 2 crew consists of four astronauts, three of which are from NASA: Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, with a fourth, Jeremy Hansen, who's from the Canadian Space Agency. Together, they are headed for a 10-day flight that will include an orbit around the moon, but it's only a flyby test mission, so they're not going to land on the moon, but instead confirm the capabilities of the systems and hardware that will be vital for the success of the Artemis missions as a whole. Artemis 2 is the second in the series of four missions with the ultimate aim of establishing the first long-term presence on the moon. This lunar space station is planned to be used for further exploration of the moon for scientific discovery, but also as a testbed for preparing human missions to Mars. In the final stages of preparing for launch, NASA plans to do what they call a wet dress rehearsal, no later than the 2nd of February, which consists of the rocket being loaded with cryogenic propellants and all the launch countdown manoeuvres run through. They also practice safely draining the propellants from the rocket. This rehearsal will be able to uncover any issues so they can be fixed ahead of the launch, which again is going to happen no later than April this year. This is definitely something we'll be keeping our eye on in the upcoming months.
Astronomers find the earliest Milky Way-type barred spiral galaxy. A team of astronomers led by Daniel Ivanov from the University of Pittsburgh have made a pretty spectacular discovery. They have found a barred spiral-type galaxy that is nearly 11.5 billion years old from the observations made by JWST. Observations by the Multi-Object Spectrograph for Infrared Exploration, MOSFIRE for short, based on the Keck 1 telescope, further confirmed the age of this galaxy. According to the Hubble sequence, galaxies are grouped into elliptical, spiral, and lenticular shapes based on their morphological characteristics. Galaxies generally begin as irregular disks. They evolve to form spiral arms extending from a central bulge, also known as a spiral galaxy. So naturally, formation of complex morphology like a barred spiral is expected to take time, and discovery of a galaxy like this from the early universe indicates that galactic structure formation may have happened much earlier than one may expect. Older barred spiral galaxies have been observed earlier, but determination of their properties was limited by observation methods used, like gravitational lensing, which distorts the shape of the galaxy, making it hard to classify it based on its morphology, and redshift measurements, which have a 10-15% uncertainty. Neither method is as definitive as spectroscopy that was used here. Discoveries like this are very exciting for the science community since they help us constrain the timeline of galactic evolution, so this is something that we will watch out for as well in the future.
Next up, we've got Lily and Louisa chatting to Professor Jonathan Tennyson about his involvement in the founding of Blue Skies Space. Professor Tennyson is the current Massey Professor of Physics at UCL, and was recently awarded the Gold Medal by the Royal Astrophysics Society. In this interview, we learn about his journey from doing a PhD in chemistry to becoming a founding member of a satellite launching company.
Hello. So joining me in the studios today, me and Lily, are interviewing Professor Jonathan Tennyson. You are a Massey Professor of Physics at UCL and also Chair of Blue Sky Space. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice. So tell us a bit about yourself and a little bit about Blue Sky Space.
Okay, well, I'm, as you've gathered from the title, an academic, and actually my day job is solving Schrodinger's equation for quantum mechanics. But 12 years ago now, me and two colleagues, Giovanna Tinetti, who also was a professor at UCL, she's now at King's, and Marcel Tassegni, decided that we wanted actually to take an alternative view of how to get data from space. And we founded a company, Blue Sky Space, with a view to basically making space much more accessible on shorter timescales and cheaper.
I guess that's a very ambitious proposal. Coming from like academia, right, and seeing these massive projects like JWST and Euclid that have taken decades to
Well, it was exactly that that got us thinking this way.
Right.
Because these projects, as you say, they take decades. They cost, JWST cost $10 billion, something like that, crazy amounts of money. And when the space agencies first started and there was nothing, that was clearly necessary. But now there's a big infrastructure of people doing Earth observation. So there's an awful lot of equipment that's site that's flown that has high technology readiness level for space flight. That you've been up there, it's proved it works. And basically, our idea was you take the things that have worked for Earth observation, you point the other way and you repeat. And you don't spend 5-10 years developing a new piece of equipment, making it absolutely the best thing ever.
Right.
You buy what you can do as much as possible off the shelf. And therefore it becomes cheaper to do it and it becomes quicker. And quicker is cheaper because obviously paying people is the major thing. So if it takes you 10 years to do a launch, you have to pay people for 10 years. If it takes you 3 years, you've on 30% of the budget. So that was the basic model, and it's still the model we're working on.
Right. So you're different that, for example, JWST and Euclid are very specialised. There's new equipment that's literally invented in the period from the time of proposal to the time of launch. So much time has passed and elapsed that technology advances so much that they're basically also using the new technology. How have you recycled Earth observation technology, and how have you innovated it, or if you have in any way?
So I think our biggest innovation is the business model. So we're not really aiming to innovate on technology. Mm. We're aiming, as I say, to use components that have already had a proven space lifetime. And it's a bit dangerous to put absolutely the newest thing in space, because Hubble notwithstanding, you normally can't fix it once it's up there.
Yeah.
So you have to be a little bit conservative, which is why the agencies go through very exhaustive testing and proving programs when they do the new stuff. Our idea was that you take stuff that actually you know works. You still have to test it when you put the thing together and all the rest of it, but at the same time you're starting from a much higher confidence level because you've got proven components in your spacecraft.
So from the moment of inception till now that MOV has been launched and your first satellite is in space and functional and observing, what did that timeline look like? What was the steps to get MOV out into space?
So the idea of the company, and I think the formal registration of the company, was in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much a shell for a year.
You know,
we knew what we wanted to do. We hadn't done anything. And I got a so-called proof of concept grant off the European Research Council. And originally that had written in a business development manager. And actually at the same time, we'd had a group of UCL master's students who were doing economics type thing, doing a research project, there were 10 of them, on feasibility of selling space data. And what we actually did, instead of hiring one very experienced person, we hired two of those,
right,
who were great. And it was very interesting. We got a small grant from Biz, as it was called in those days, to do a customer survey. The company in Newcastle who did it were fine. But if you ever wanted to speak to anyone who wasn't English speaking, they charged us huge translation fees. The students, being multinational students, just spoke the languages. So we divided the world up according to, you know, the Spanish speaker got South America and
nice,
so on.
Yeah.
So this worked rather well. And we developed a level of data, a level of interest in customers. The problem, you know, I said we want to do this quickly, and we've actually been 11 years to get something in space, which is, we would have liked to have been quicker. Frankly, the problem is raising the money.
Right.
So we had various tries at the best way of raising the money, and we didn't originally think we would go fully commercial, but essentially that's what we've done.
Right.
So we had a commercial grant fundraising round, aided by some grant funding as well. So the MOV is partially funded by the European Commission. Basically, the building costs were funded by the Eurovision Commission. We had to pay the launch costs, and we're running it.
And what does your customer base look like? Is it just academics?
It's academics. It can be. It's not exclusive universities. We have at least, I'm not sure how many, but at least one from research at labs, but it's basically it's academics.
Right. So you got your potential clients, you got the funding, and now you've got the building.
Mm-hmm.
What did that stage look like?
The building of MOVE was very quick. We were under 4 years in writing the grant proposal to getting in space. So Blue Sky Space does not have any building capability. We have software development capability, but the building we go to contractors and we buy, you know, for instance, we bought the telescope off an Italian company. Okay. The main CubeSat itself was built in Hungary and the whole thing was assembled in Hungary and test vibration testing and things like that in Hungary. Right. And then we had a Dutch contractor who did the instrumentation.
Okay.
So we go to the specialist companies for them. And that interestingly, is becoming an increasingly commercial thing that you can get several companies and get them to bid against each other because it's now a big area. You know, yeah. It's not that there's one unique company who does everything.
And on the software, can I ask, development side, like, were you building pipelines, essentially?
Yes, we have a thing called StarDrive, which is our main interface for the customers. Right. And that's a data pipeline. It's place where the data will go when it comes down from the satellite, but also where you can build communities within the group who are doing it, and it's general information flow in all directions.
So you take the raw data and the final product is the reduced, or you usually say the reduced data.
Yes.
With all the calibration done by you.
Yeah. Okay. So we're doing the calibration, for instance. Yeah. So the data will be actually, I think, available on more than one level, but basically customers will get reduced data.
And when do you expect to have your first data release?
So I'm speaking now in January 2025, and we hope to have serious data starting in about a month.
Okay.
We will release it to customers, not in one big release, but as things become available. We need to reduce the data.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is, and this is a guess, that we will, first time we do it, will take a bit longer because we probably just want to learn exactly how we're doing it, do it correctly. At the moment, we need to characterise the spacecraft very well in order to aid things like that data reduction.
I don't think we've really talked about what is MOVE.
So the MOVE satellite will cover a range of wavelengths in the visible and ultraviolet going from 200 nanometers to 700 nanometers. There's a big gap in ultraviolet capability in observing at the moment. Mm-hmm. So when we went out and started talking to customers, people very rapidly identified this as something that they wanted. It's a CubeSat, so it's small. You can think of it the size of your microwave. Weighs just under 20 kilograms. It has a 13-centimeter telescope. Resolving power, not very big, but 15, 20, that sort of area. So you can see spectra. You don't see very sharp features, but you get some variation. The main purpose is to look at variability, that we will go back and look at... You can do two things. You can either stare at a star for a long time and see whether it changes, or you can revisit at different schedules. So that's the major thing. It's being used for quite a variety of other things, including star formation and various other activities. Looking at some stars are just known to vary, so you monitor them for a bit. But particularly interested in things like stellar flares around stars that are known to support planetary systems, because if you're looking for habitable planets, it's actually quite important to know whether they're being absolutely deluged with flux of radiation from their star on a regular basis, which would might kill any form of life forming, or whether they're actually quite a quiescent environment. So that's one of the things we're looking at. So the whole variety, we have actually 10 different science themes going in, and that's for the first year proposal. They will be revised for the second year, but that's what we've done for the first year of operation.
And as an amateurist, so I don't really know a lot about observation, but what part of the sky are you focusing on?
So we basically have view all the way around the ecliptic. That's the plane that the galaxy is in. Obviously, the bit you look at varies with the time of year and things like that, because what we don't want to do is look at the sun, because that will burn everything out. So you're looking opposite direction from the sun. But basically, within a few degrees either side of the ecliptic, which is where the majority of stars in the galaxy are, we can see.
Nice. And what's the depth of the field? How far in...
Well, it's not so much how far you view, it's how bright the thing you're looking at
has. Yeah, I guess.
So if you have a very bright star, you can look at it quite a long way away. The coolest stars we're looking at are M-dwarfs, which are not terribly bright in the ultraviolet anyway.
Yeah.
Those really have to be quite close to us because they're just not very bright.
Yeah. And obviously you
can integrate longer, but at some point it becomes not useful. And actually, that's one of the things we're characterising at the moment, because we had a estimated temperature, and the things you get are things like dark currents in the instruments. And actually now we're calibrating what we're actually getting in the instruments.
You're working on another satellite.
Yeah.
I was wondering what you've learned from the process of making and launching MOV and how you're applying that to your next satellite.
So it's interesting. We went into Twinkle with a science objective because basically the three of us who formed the company had been working on exoplanets and we knew what we wanted for exoplanets. And then we designed a satellite. MOV sort of happened the other way around, that we had a satellite and we hadn't really worked. We weren't experts in the UV and we hadn't really designed a science program. And what we've learned is actually the Twinkle way around of doing it is the right way to do it. You start with the science. I mean, I think you to a scientist, you're sitting there nodding, you know that you should start with the science. But as a business, we sort of learned that in real time slightly. So I would say that's the biggest take home. I'm sure at the technical level, we've learned lots of things. We've learned how to negotiate launches, things like launch insurance, which we had a big debate. We took launch insurance, but whether we should or shouldn't, you know. Actually, over the time we've been doing this, the cost of launches has come down significantly, as has the cost of launch insurance, because launches have got more reliable. So, and we've learned, we have a much better understanding of the industrial infrastructure, who does what well, who it's good to do business with. So that's also important.
Yeah. How was the experience for you personally about launching something into space? So you showed these pictures in your presentation of the rocket with all of these payloads. And I didn't realize a payload is literally just stuck to the side of the rocket.
Yeah, well, they have a fairing. The picture I showed had it open so you can see all the...
Yeah.
They do actually have a thing that goes around it as it launches, but then they throw it off and they chuck them out one after the other. We were released about an hour into the process of chucking up all the satellites. Because the SpaceX rocket went up with, I think, 140 satellites on it.
And you said you were able to watch the full launch.
Yeah, so it was an amazing experience. The launch was postponed 5 times. So it was the 6th attempt we got it. Attempt number 5, the cat got down 15 minutes to launch. It was all sitting there on the launch pad. And suddenly the cat stopped. First, I thought the internet had just frozen, but no, they detected a problem with the mission and they froze it. And then 2 days later, we launched. So it was amazing, you know, after more than a decade, actually to see something going up in space with your instrument on it. I mean, so yeah, that was, and they put on it, you know, they had cameras on the space rocket so you could see what was going on. You got commentary of the different levels of it going on. You got commentary as they missioned the space. They announced that each of the satellites were released. So you can imagine a big chair went up in the room the minute they said, MOV released, you know. And then even greater, 2 hours later when a signal was picked up from our ground station. So we had communications with satellites. It was there and it was working. So that was also, you know, tremendous, tremendous moment.
No, it sounds incredible.
Yeah. I think we all kind of dream of being in the control room as something launches. But not many people can say that they actually have had that experience. So MOV is the first. You've now got, hopefully, moving on to the next missions.
Yeah.
What are you excited about in terms of these next missions? Are there new challenges that you're going to try and tackle?
Well, Twinkle is definitely a new level of challenge because it's a much bigger satellite. So if you just think in terms of telescopes, MOV has a 13-centimetre telescope. Twinkle were probably looking, approaching half a metre, maybe 45 centimetres, something like that. So it's more like a small domestic fridge than a microwave. It's no longer CubeSat territory. So the whole launch is more complicated, but also the build is more complicated. The major difference is the ultraviolet, you don't really have to cool. Mm-hmm. We just vent this thing into outer space and that's enough. For if you're going to do the infrared, and Twinkle will be an infrared satellite because that's where the real business is in exoplanet work. Just like our own atmosphere, the spectrum is very complicated, the infrared. And it's also why you need to be above the atmosphere because mm-hmm. you don't want to take spectra of exoplanets through an atmosphere of a planet. So we have to cool, so it makes it a much more complicated mission. And we also want a higher resolution, so you need more sophisticated spectrometers. So it's a step up in terms of sophistication, in terms of money and all the rest of it. But we are pushing ahead, and I think we have a fairly confident, we have a roadmap of how to do it.
And I suppose as a business, you want to be the first to do something or you want a unique space, but you've also talked about the science, about the complementarity with other missions and other kind of instruments. How much is that a balance? How much does that weigh in when you're designing missions?
So there are quite a lot of different answers to that question. Let's start with the end bit first. Obviously, we're a company, so we have to have things that customers want. If there was already a fleet of telescopes up there that we're all using, there'd be no point in us doing it.
Yeah.
So you are balanced against what's coming, what's available. You know, I said already, I think with MOV, that there was quite clearly a need in the UV. There was a lack of UV capability up there, and that's what led us into thinking in terms of the UV in the first place. Mm-hmm. exoplanets, there are, you know, James Webb is doing exoplanet observations. There's the aerial mission due to be launched by the European Space Agency. But there's a huge demand for data. I mean, James Webb is, and I always thought it'd be like this. It's great, but it's frustrating because it's sort of, you want more, you see a little bit of it. What we will be able to do is just increase the volume of data hugely. So the complementarity also comes in. So something we're very interested in doing with MOVE is actually having combined observing proposals with other missions. Mm-hmm. So we have capability that maybe other missions want but don't have. So if you have a joint observations with them, you can actually leverage our data and their data and get more by combining, maybe much more by combining both. So I think there's also that actually other missions can be collaborative as well as, obviously, if we're doing exactly the same thing, they may be competitive, but you can use them in a collaborative way. And that's not just space missions. You can have people on the ground and you can't do UV observations from the ground. So you want the UV from space at the same time as you're doing your ground observation. And that's something actually we're exploring very actively at the moment with MOVE.
And that complementarity with missions, like everyone's very excited for the Habitable Worlds Observatory, being able to use your data and cross that with
so the Habitable Worlds Observatory is very much on our radar for a possible mission we would have complementary with. And exactly that's where things like, you know, is this star flaring like mad and destroying the equilibrium of the atmosphere on a regular basis, or is it quite quiescent, comes in as an important parameter?
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting to see someone whose origins aren't in astronomy or astrophysics to sort of suddenly plunge into the depths of making and launching a satellite. Because you came into this fairly late in your academic career. Like, how much have you learned and how much have you moved towards astronomy?
Okay, so just for the listeners, give a bit of detail. I have a first degree in chemistry and a PhD in chemistry. I did a first postdoc also in chemistry in the Netherlands. I then moved to Daresbury Laboratory, which is a government research laboratory between Manchester and Liverpool. I actually lived in Manchester when I worked at Daresbury. And I joined actually what was then just a theory group. So it was a joint physics and chemistry group. And then when there was something called New Blood Lectureships launched in the mid-1980s, I was lucky enough to get one, but I got one in a physics department. I'd never worked in a physics department in my life. And the group I got it in was actually run by a very eminent scientist, Mike Seaton, who was an atomic physicist who did a lot of astronomy. So I suddenly found myself in an astronomy group and I started going to astronomy seminars, and I didn't understand half of them at the beginning, and you can't ask completely dumb questions at the end of the seminar, but at lunch the following day, the group very patiently explained everything to me, and after a year or so, I began to get some of it and so on, and I learned. Then I started actually doing quantum mechanical calculations relevant for particularly cool star atmospheres, looking at things like how hot water absorbs light and emits light at very high temperatures and things like that. And I was doing that quite happily for, I don't know, 15 years or so. Rather low level of funding. Normally I could get one person to work on a line list at a time, and a line list takes 3 years, so our level of productivity was not very high. And then Giovanna Tinetti, already mentioned, was a co-founder of Blue Sky Space with me, came and gave a seminar in 2007 at UCL. And she had three data points from the Spitzer Space Telescope looking at a planetary transit in near infrared. And it showed a structure. It showed the planet was changing size at different wavelengths. And she said, I'm sure it's water, but I can't get my model to fit. So I went to her after the seminar. I said, whose water data are you using? And she told me, I said, it's rubbish, use ours. A week later, I got an extremely excited email saying, it fits. And we sent this off to Nature, called Tentative Detection of Water in a Transiting Exoplanet. And after usual toing and throwing, Nature accepted it and crossed the word tentative off the beginning of the title. And I decided at that moment that MDORS and all the rest of it were quite fun, but wasn't really going anywhere, and exoplanets was clearly the future topic. So I decided to reorient what we were doing to providing the data for exoplanets. Now, in a sense, this is a branding change because the data is the same. My water line list that I made for MDORS is just as good for an exoplanet. A water line list is a water line list. But the molecules we chose were aimed as exoplanets. So we had a very early conference when I first started. We organised a conference and got astronomers. And one of the questions we asked them was what molecule they're interested in. And I remember memorably one of them stood up, I'm only interested in three molecules, methane, methane and methane. So we got the message that we went and made a methane line list as an absolute priority. Now, I was fortunate enough to get significant funding from the European Research Council to then go away and start creating a database of all these lines. So I was working on exoplanets when this came up. So that project is called the ExoMol project and is still going. And I'm working with Giovanna. She was a big consumer of our ExoMol data. And the fact that I already was a director of another company, I think helped Giovanna think in terms of having me on board to come at the moment when she was thinking in terms of founding a company like Blue Sky Space to launch space missions. Because I wouldn't say I'm a businessman, but I have slightly more business experience than most academics do. Probably I knew the right people to talk to is what it amounted to. So that was my journey. And you're right, it's quite a long way from a young chemist who found he wasn't very good at practical chemistry and discovered quantum mechanics and you could solve these things by solving equations rather than burning your fingers to someone launching space missions. But I think for most people who have any sort of career, it's a journey. I'm very unusual that I've worked for one employer for 40 years. That's an outdated model, which probably your generation not had the benefit of. But it doesn't mean you do the same thing for 40 years.
That's so good.
Brilliant. So thank you so much for your time.
That was Professor Dennison talking to Lily and Louisa. Next, we have the Chart Bite. In this month's Chart Bite, Louis and Josh chat with Will McGinn about his role in the Advanced Radio Instrumentation Group at the University of Manchester, talking about designing and testing novel low-noise amplifiers for use in radio astronomy experiments and how these technologies can be used in worlds outside of astronomy.
Hi, I'm Louis, and I'm here with Josh today, and we're talking to Dr. Will McGinn, who is part of the Advanced Radio Instrumentation Group at the University of Manchester. Hi, Will.
Hi.
So, just to start off, can you give us a quick description of your academic journey up to this point? How did you get here, and what have you done previously?
I'm currently a postdoc at the University of Manchester. Before that, I did my PhD and undergraduate at Cardiff University. Before coming to Manchester, I was purely on an engineering side of things. And then coming to Manchester, I started working for the radio astronomy applications.
Great. So you work in the Advanced Radio Instrumentation Group. So what is this group? What do you do? And just give us a bit of information about it, please.
Yeah, so the Advanced Instrumentation Group is a cross-department interdisciplinary research group. It's between the George Wilbank Centre for Astrophysics in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, and then the Department of Electrical and Electronic Engineering as well. A specialty is really the receivers for radio telescopes, particularly a component called the low noise amplifier. These are really quite similar to the kind of technologies used in a lot of things like communications, for example, but for radio astronomy, it's taken to the extreme where the sensitivity of these systems is important beyond anything else, really. So our specialty is really pushing that sensitivity from the components.
Cool. Why are these low-noise amplifiers used specifically for electromagnetic signals from space, or I guess in generally across radio astronomy?
So the signals coming from space are naturally very, very tiny. So the first thing you want to do is boost all the signals up, boost the levels up to help with detecting these signals. All of the electronics in these receivers will add some sort of noise and interference into the signals being received as well. So really our amplifiers and receivers, we're looking to boost the signals as much as possible, but add as little noise and interference into the system as we can as well.
So these are quite complicated devices, but if I could ask you, could you maybe give a simple explanation of how they work? You don't need to go into too much detail, but...
Yeah, no problem. The amplifiers that we build are based on transistors. So these are a little bit different from transistors that are in a computer CPU, for example, which are, they're working in a digital format, so they're either turned on or off. These are working in what we call an analog way. So the input is continually varying. And then you can imagine it a bit like a water tap. As you turn the tap, more or less water comes out, depending on how much you turn the tap on. It's similar for these transistors. As the signal at the input of the transistor varies, it lets more electrical current through, so you can use that as a way to amplify these signals.
Cool. I assume they're not built the same way as a water tap, but if you just give us like a quick play-by-play of how you design them, how they get manufactured, and I guess what I assume is quite important is how you test them as well.
Yes. Our group, our specialty is the full range of that sort of workflow, really. So it starts with a semiconductor foundry. These are devices made from various semiconductor materials, and then these are fabricated by specialists, sometimes university groups, sometimes commercial companies. They will send us information about their transistors, such as the performance that they've measured, or sometimes they will send us the samples of transistors for us to measure to extract that performance. This is what we call models. So we will make transistor models. These we can then use for the design process. So we will then make a circuit design. And then the circuit design we send back to the foundry or the group that are going to fabricate these amplifiers. They will make the amplifiers. They are a little integrated circuit amplifiers. So each chip is between about 1 millimeter square and a couple of millimeters square. They will send back the fabricated chips to us, and then we will put them in a package. Usually for our applications, it's a metal package of some kind. And then that can be integrated and built into a complete receiver system.
Nice. So I've got a question about the testing setup that you use for these LNAs. So how do you mimic, I guess, the receiver chain in a telescope to be able to test these? Because obviously we're looking at very faint signals from space. How do you test this in a lab condition?
It can be very difficult to test. Initially, a lot of what we're testing is we test them in a way that isn't that similar to how they'll be used on the telescope, and then gradually getting more and more closer to a complete receiver system. For example, some of the complexities that we have for radio astronomy is a lot of these instruments are cooled to cryogenic temperatures to help get rid of the thermal noise that would add interference into our system. So we have in the lab upstairs, we have some cryogenic testing systems, so we can put these amplifiers into the cryostats, cool them down to usually about between 10 and 20 Kelvin, and then run the tests there. We also have room temperature setups as well. So typically these cryogenic setups will take between a few hours and a few days to cool down and to warm back up again. So we always test at room temperature first, just to make sure everything works well and you don't waste your time cooling down. And it happens all the time. Loose connections, as things cool down, materials contract, things can become loose, or it's a very complex setup. So having room temperature testing is important as well.
Cool. So as someone who is not involved in instrumentation at all, I'm actually really interested to know what are the kind of, I guess, mathematical or not, what sort of the parameters you are specifically looking to test? Because I'd assume, you know, you're not going to imagine you've just got a signal. Do you use stuff like imaginary signals or?
Yeah, so for the actual amplifiers, there's two real key parameters we're looking at. One is the gain. So this is how much it will amplify a signal. And the second is what's called noise figure or noise temperature. And this is the amount of extra noise that the amplifier is going to add to your signal. So you want to make the noise as low as you can and the gain as high as you can. Another important aspect of this is what's called power dissipation. So you have to give some DC power to these amplifiers in order for them to operate. And the more DC power you give them, the more heat you generate in the amplifier, but the more gain you might be able to get out of it. So it's a bit of a balance between making sure you have low DC power, but high enough gain. The problem with DC power is that the heat generated, if you generate too much heat inside the cryostat, then that can raise the temperature of the cryostat and affect the rest of your system. For our applications, it's not too bad. We can generate quite a bit of heat and not have too much of a worry. But for a lot of quantum applications that are becoming of interest now, it's quite similar technologies, but taken down to millikelvin levels. And there you cannot generate any heat without affecting the system.
What frequency ranges are you building these LNAs to cover? And in an astronomical context, what sort of experiments would these be used for?
Okay, so for frequency ranges, our group are working anywhere from around 1 gigahertz up to a few hundred gigahertz. We have different amplifiers to cover different ranges within that. Typically, an amplifier will cover what's called an octave frequency band, so that's a doubling of frequency, so 1 to 2 gigahertz or 2 to 4 gigahertz. A couple of our devices that we're working on at sort of lower frequencies, we're looking at around 1 gigahertz or covering quite wide band applications, like we're looking at trying to design a 4 to 20 gigahertz amplifier. And then we're also looking at very high frequencies as well. So we do a lot of work looking at upgrades for the ALMA telescope, for example. So we worked on LNAs covering a 67 to 116 gigahertz band, covering ALMA bands 2 and 3. And then we're looking at new amplifiers at the moment. We've just got our first generation of these devices in the lab at the moment that we're working on. But these will cover 125 to 211 gigahertz and then 211 to 373 gigahertz. So that's one device for ALMA bands 4 and 5 and another for ALMA bands 6 and 7. And this is really the cutting edge of where this amplifier research is at the moment, the high frequencies. As semiconductor industries develop new transistor processes that are capable of operating at higher frequencies, we're really looking to come in and use those for things like radio astronomy to try and get the benefits and try and push the frequencies that we can operate up higher and higher.
I spy with my little eye, you've brought us a little model in of one of these low noise amplifiers. You talk about working in different frequency bands. We will try and get a photo of it out with the interview. Does the design differ massively when you're going between different frequency bands?
Yeah, they can do. So at lower frequencies, below, say, about 30 gigahertz, amplifiers will typically use like cable connectors, cables between components. At frequencies above that, cables can become quite lossy. We tend to switch more to what's called a waveguide. So this is almost like a hollow metal tube that the electromagnetic signals can propagate along. And these are really convenient for cryogenic applications as well, because they're much easier to keep cool than cables are, because you don't have the center conductor that you have to try and cool somehow. So this particular model that I've bought is Alma Band 2 amplifier. So this is operating around 100 gigahertz. This is an exact replica of our actual LNA. It's been 3D printed in the university specifically for things like this, so we can give people the amplifier without having to worry about handing someone like thousands and thousands of pounds worth of hardware that's static sensitive. So on here, we've got two waveguide channels, one for the input and the output. We have the little amplifier mimic chip that's about 1 millimeter square. We have what are called transitions on either side. So these are little antennas that take the signals coming along the waveguides onto a metal transmission line, and then at the output, put them back out into the waveguide again. And we also have a normal electronic PCB, just does a little bit of power conditioning for the DC bias that's coming to the amplifier.
It is crazy how small it is and how impactful it is in the entire radio telescope design. That's cool.
So one of the things we're working towards is we've really reached the limit of how small that we can make these now. Potentially we can make them a little bit smaller, but in a meaningful way, this is about as small as you can make them. Going to higher frequencies, this poses some problems because a lot of the limits of these are now the interfaces and the connectors between the different components. So they, irrespective of the frequency, the waveguides, connections and screw holes have to be there to connect things together. As you go up in frequency, the length of the waveguide channel means there's more losses at higher frequencies. So although at higher frequencies it might be the same size as this, you have more losses from the package that you're putting your amplifier into. So at high frequencies, we want to try and make everything closer together, try and get rid of those interfaces between components. It makes the overall system more complex, but hopefully you should get a better result in the end. And this is the second model that I've bought, is an amplifier and a mixer integrated into the same package. So the idea here is we're at really high frequencies, so we put a bit of amplification on the signal, and then the mixer down converts the frequency to something that's much, much easier to process and to digitize later on. In the past, these would have been separate components, but a lot of our work now is looking at how we can put these into the same package, how we can minimize the space between them, and also how we can take advantage of them being in the same package, because you don't have to have things in the same order anymore. You can mix and match where you put the components in the chain to try and get some benefits. So our work now is really understanding how you can use this to your advantage.
I've got a question. Have there ever been, or are there, competing designs for the same frequency bands? Do you ever have to choose one design or the other, or have you had two ones that you've tested and compared?
Yeah, so we always try to make multiple designs to cover a frequency band. That could be as simple as having a design you finish and then a couple of little tweaks or variants on that just to vary things a little bit. One of the important things about these amplifiers is to make them what's called stable. It's quite possible that if you don't quite get the design right, that you end up with, instead of an amplifier, you end up with an oscillator, and then it's just unusable. So quite often we'll make tweaks so that we'll have a version that's intended for absolute best performance, and then we'll make a few tweaks to compromise the performance a little bit, but increase that stability. So hopefully you end up with something that works quite well. We'll also do different approaches to the same frequency bands. So trying to do things like a smaller size or less power, lower power requirements, higher gain, lower gain, different factors really. There are also different groups that will work on the same frequency range. So we've in a way competed with people in the past on designs, and there are various groups around the world that will try to design these types of amplifiers. So sometimes the projects to supply them can get a little bit competitive, but in the way that any research is really, there's a little bit of competition there to try and get the funding and try and get the best performance out of your devices.
Earlier you mentioned the ALMA experiment. I just want to ask, is there any other experiments that you've worked on as part of the Advanced Radio Instrumentation Group? Or what is the exact relationship between the group and the ALMA experiment? You know, how does that communication between the collaboration and the group work?
Yeah, so for ALMA specifically, we work with the European Southern Observatory, and they have a fund for ALMA development projects. So they will have upgrades, ideas, and frequency bands that they're interested in working on, and they will communicate that out to all the people that they work with in Europe, and to a certain extent around other places in the world as well. And then, so we will talk to them and they'll say, we want to try and upgrade this frequency band. Can you work on some amplifiers? And then we'll say, okay, well, we want to, these are our ideas for, this is what we think we can do, and we'll apply to them for the funding. So this is where the integrated LNA and mixer idea came from. This was our way. This was a funded by the European Southern Observatory to develop this technology. Outside of ALMA, we're also working on a few different things. One of the big projects that we had recently was called the Caruso receiver. So this was the cryogenic array for users of the Sardinia Observatory. And this was a joint collaboration between our group in Manchester and the Rutherford Appleton Lab in Oxford. They have a long history of making receivers and instrumentation for radio astronomy and for other areas as well. And this project was for INAF, for their Sardinian radio telescope. It was a 70 to 116 gigahertz multi-pixel array. So typically a radio astronomy receiver would have a single receiver or a single pixel. So that would give you a single point on the sky that you can use to observe. A multi-pixel array has multiple receivers in the same instrument, so that'll give you multiple points to use to observe on the sky. In this case, we had 16 receivers in the instrument, so that means 16 points on the sky, and it just speeds up how quickly you can make observations across the sky, which is particularly useful if you want to map across the sky to look for specific things. So this was a real challenge for our technology. When you have a single receiver in your instrument, space is, it's not unlimited, but it's certainly not a top priority. For multi-pixel instruments, you want to make sure that the receivers inside the instrument need to be positioned quite closely together. There's specific ways that they need to be positioned so you get the beams properly going from the dish onto the sky. So for us, that meant everything had to be sit within a very tight footprint. So we had to shrink everything, miniaturize all of the components. And this is what's the outcomes of that project are also driving our current research in looking at how we can further shrink all of these components and integrate more together to get more into a smaller volume, basically. Ideally, we'd like even more pixels within the same instrument. The more you can get in the same instrument, the more beams you can have on the sky, the more observations you can do. But the technical challenge goes up dramatically the more beams you add, particularly cryogenic, where you're trying to get all of the cables have to go through the side of the cryostat, so that lets more heat come into the cryostat. So you have to have a bigger cooler to keep all of the instrument cold. It becomes a real technical challenge.
Cool. We touched on it very briefly earlier, but what's kind of the most exciting thing about the future for this kind of technology to you?
The exciting thing for me is going from the raw sort of transistors that the foundries send to us and producing the finished amplifiers or other components, and then getting to put them onto a radio telescope somewhere. Or we're sort of trying to branch out a little bit at the moment, looking at other scientific applications. So it's that idea of using this interesting technology to do interesting science, really. So for me, that's the exciting thing, really, is trying to take this technology and use it in a way that helps people do the science.
Kind of field testing it. It was when you've lab tested it and now you want to get it into various experiments.
Yeah, exactly. It's, it would be very easy to go and get a job in this field making things that go in people's phones or in computers and things like that. But actually being able to make technology to go into a radio telescope is pretty cool.
Just finally, so you said that you're kind of branching out and looking at maybe non-astronomical uses of this technology. So I think you mentioned quantum stuff earlier. How is this used in quantum systems? Or
yeah, so the kind of systems that are in quantum computers, for example, they use signals on these kind of frequencies, sort of microwave kind of frequencies, to interact with their qubits and their sensors. And the readout electronics for that have to be incredibly sensitive to detect anything from these. So our amplifiers would go into the cryostat and that readout chain, working in exactly the same way as they would for radio astronomy. You're just trying to amplify a very tiny signal, but adding as little noise to it as possible. The difference is, for radio astronomy, you're taking a signal from up in the sky. For a lot of these quantum experiments, the signal's originating from something inside your cryostat. There's a lot of interesting work going on in the university on various different quantum systems. I'm definitely not in a position to talk about that. It's definitely not my area of expertise, but I think what we're trying to do there is trying to look at, similar to the radio astronomy, how we can support that science taking place with our systems and our technologies.
I mean, it's also just cool just to highlight, I think you just said it then, like, this is taking a small signal and boosting it massively with such little noise. And you can imagine the possibilities across all sorts of science that can be used for.
It's exactly. Cool. One of the things to remember as well is, one of the reasons that this work gets funded isn't necessarily to do the science. The science is cool and the science is interesting and exciting. But actually, the technologies that we're developing then go on and are used in big communication systems, and things like 6G is becoming a thing. People are starting to talk about that, and that's going to, part of that will be quite high frequency systems, so you can get really high data rates and things. So that's why a lot of investment is going into semiconductor technologies now, is to make things like 6G and high data rate communications possible. So a lot of our work is trying to A, be part of that development, but also use that development in a way that you can use it towards radio astronomy, science, quantum applications, all these interesting and exciting applications that are the sort of thing that capture people's imagination, really.
So, thanks, Will. That was really interesting. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Yep. Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant.
Cool. That ends the JodBite for this episode.
Also, last month, we were honoured to be invited to the 21st Appleton Space Conference, hosted by RAL Space. The conference covered all aspects of space research, from small startup companies launching CubeSats to the biggest international collaborations to develop governing laws and treaties for space development. During lunch, Louisa and I recorded some soundbites with an array of conference attendees on what they do in space, from AI to astronomy, an economist and a meteorologist.
Hi, I'm Sushma, co-founder and CEO of Deep Planet. We are a geospatial AI company, come out of Oxford 7 years ago, and we're leading geospatial AI for agriculture. We're winners of the ESAFI first cohort, and we've won some grant funding to help us advance our geospatial AI technologies. And so we're building a foundation model for which we do get some funding, but more importantly, we get the technical support and the mentoring and compute services, which is essential for advancing the boundaries of geospatial AI and Earth observation.
Wow. So what's one of the first things you're going to do with this funding, sort of the problems that you're going to address?
Yeah, so the work is focused around how do we monitor soil health from space. And so we use satellite data, combining it with some advanced technologies such as the foundation model to monitor and predict what is the health of the soil in terms of soil organic carbon, which essentially lends itself to regenerative agriculture and how farmers can benefit by improving the health of the soil, as well as improving yield and finding ways where there is mitigating risk, climate risk, by improving carbon in the soil.
Wow. How did you find founding a company in the space sector? What were some of the challenges?
It's like a full circle. We started at ESABEC about 7 years ago. We essentially had a lot of support from the European Space Agency to build out our first proof of concept and launch from scratch, from an idea into building a proof of concept and then, you know, building out a business around that. It has been, as all startups, as all entrepreneurial journeys, it has been challenging. But having the backing of the European Space Agency, UK Space Agency, and other organizations, and STFC for that matter, providing both technical as well as financial support has been instrumental to our success so far. And so we've grown from, we started out of Oxford, now we've grown across four geographies, monitoring over 100,000 hectares of farms globally, helping farmers, businesses and governments help and mitigate climate risk through improving the health of the soil and the crops.
Hello, do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So my name is Aprajita Verma. I'm a senior researcher at the University of Oxford, and I work on various telescopes, but mostly the European Extremely Large Telescope and the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which is what I spoke about today.
Everyone is very excited for Rubin. What
makes this telescope stand out from the rest?
So I think really what it is mapping speed and the quality of the data that you can get from that. Usually astronomers are kind of either looking at things in very high resolution or things that are very faint, but not usually both. And Rubin sits in a bit of that parameter space where it can map huge areas of sky very deep, but also as a good image quality. So the image quality we get from any ground-based telescope that's limited by the atmosphere, but still it's just that combination of those three things that make Rubin really special. And then on top of that, we have the time axis. So because it will be observing the same bits of sky repeatedly, you can actually build up a movie of the sky, and it will be over 10 years, which is actually quite incredible in terms, if you think of any of our astronomical surveys, they don't last that long. They don't revisit the same bits of sky over and over again. So they're really, now I'm saying the four things that Rubin's really stand out for. You've got that huge combination of depth, spatial resolution, and mapping speed, and then you have the time axis. So you'll get variable sources, transient sources, things that explode, things that move, that we just haven't had on that scale before.
And that transient universe, we've dabbled in it, but there's so much left to be explored. So is there anything in particular that you're looking, you're really excited to look into with Rubin? Or?
Well, my background is in extragalactic astronomy, and I do a lot of work with on gravitational lenses, so strong gravitational lenses, and they are really rare, and they're even rarer when supernovae go off in them. So we only, if you imagine, it's been about 40 years since we discovered strong gravitational lenses observationally. But really with Euclid and LSST or Rubin, we're going from knowing thousands of objects to hundreds of thousands of objects. And like I said, some small fraction of those will also have supernovae going off in them. And they're really useful for many things. They tell you stuff about kind of the galaxies that the supernovae are going off in. So you can use the amplification and magnification due to lensing to boost your signal to reach fainter host galaxies and supernovae. But also by measuring supernovae events in these strong gravitational lenses, you can actually constrain cosmology. I won't be able to go into the details of that, but they're kind of, again, lighthouses to help you understand the cosmological parameters of the universe and the fundamental things like dark energy that is really one of the most active areas of cosmology at the moment. And strong lensing gives you an alternative probe into constraining those cosmological parameters. But that's not all I'm interested in. I think there's just so much. I think we're just going to be overwhelmed with transient, variable, moving things. You know, it's 10 million alerts a night. So if you imagine 10 years of 10 million alerts a night, I think any of that will be exciting, and just learning more about kind of pieces of the time domain parameter space that we've just never probed, or just the different kinds of sources that we've just never really mapped the universe with that kind of time resolution before. So it will just be incredible.
And just very quickly, you mentioned about the ELT. What do we have to look forward to with that one?
I could start another 2-minute conversation about that. Well, probably more like 50 minutes or longer. So the ELT is really interesting when you compare it and contrast it to Rubin, because you've got something that's mapping a third of the sky it can see a night, which is Rubin. Whereas with the ELT, you're actually going to tiny, tiny, tiny scales. So its field of view for one of the instruments is about an arc minute, versus the 3.5 square degrees that Rubin can do. So what you can expect with the ELT over Rubin is that you do your detailed studies with the ELT. So you have even higher resolution. So the big mirror on the ELT gives you high spatial resolution, but you can also collect more photons. So, you know, even looking at kind of, we see these pictures of like giant molecular clouds in the Milky Way, but imagine doing that in an external galaxy, which is what you can do with the ELT. So you have this incredible zoom power, which, you know, to give your listeners a kind of feeler for what that means. So if you put your digital TV at 20 kilometers away from you, you could see a single pixel. So that's the kind of zoom factor that the ELT has. And that means that you can study objects in great detail. So you can think of Rubin as finding the interesting things, and the ELT then having the sensitivity and the resolution and a different set of instruments to really start, you know, understanding those objects in much more detail. So they do have kind of like a partnership, well, not, I shouldn't say partnership, but complementarity in how they're surveying the universe.
Perfect. So hi, do you want to introduce yourself, give us a little summary?
Hello, I am Carla Doricott. I am an MSc student at the University of Bath. I specialise in advanced machine learning. My undergraduate degree was applied artificial intelligence with physics. I mainly work on robotics and autonomous systems, and I currently am working on EnviroBotSim, which is a fully deployable simulation built in MATLAB with Simulink, and it's to monitor environments with computer vision, reinforcement learning and multi-sensor fusion.
Wow. Wow, yeah. So you kind of touched on that briefly, but what applications does this kind of simulation have to our life or to the space industry?
So the project started off as AgriBotSim. So it's mainly for the agricultural industry. So essentially, AgriBotSim can identify fungal, bacterial and viral disease in plants with 99.2% accuracy. And that uses a convolutional neural network that is on a trained network. It's called MobileNet V2, which is the best for image classifying. And I am currently building my own convolutional neural network during my master's to apply to this project, which has evolved into EnviroBotSim, which I'm currently training it on Saturn's Moon Titan's dataset, so it can go into planetary environmental monitoring, not just on Earth.
Wow. And then the long-term goal is to then apply that to...
Yeah, different planets, different sectors. It's very scalable. It could be scaled to defence, it could be scaled to agriculture, it could be scaled to space.
And I think more and more we see that AI strategies can be applied across multiple subjects.
Initially, this is just a way of collating data to make decisions, look after the planet.
Hi there. My name's Will Leckie. I am co-founder and director of KNOWSpace, K-N-O-W. We are a space economics consultancy, so I'm a space economist. We work across the space industry on pretty much everything from Earth observation to space weather to launch and everything in between. And yeah, that's me.
What's the most exciting project you've either working on now or have worked on in the past?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I like what I do because of the variety. And being able to work across the industry, there's so much exciting stuff going on. If I did have to pick one, it would probably be some of the big space science missions, like the Gaia mission, which was essentially a big map of the galaxy, the Milky Way, and showing the impact that has, and the sort of technological advancement that happens, and the often unpredictable spillover benefits, like improved cancer detection, and how we get real life benefit from investments in cutting edge research.
How did you get into space economics?
I completely fell into it. So I studied economics because I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I worked as a civil servant for a while, saw a UK space agency job advertised, and thought, oh, why not? I can go and do that for a year or two, and then go and do something more sensible. And here I am, 12 years later.
Is there anything about being a space economist that surprises you, or what does that actually entail?
I think a lot of the time we come in on the so what question. I mean, I'm privileged in the space industry to work with so many brilliant scientists and engineers, and we wouldn't have an industry without them. We can often help by helping them talk the language of the general public or the Treasury or whoever else, and help them show the real world impact that you can get from these amazing to cutting edge technologies. So yeah, it's just the sheer breadth. I mean, we talk about the space industry, but it's so broad, and it covers every satellite is up there for a reason, to provide data or imagery for use on Earth. And it's those real world applications, and it's all about making life better, whether that's economic benefits, societal benefits, flooding prevention, disaster relief, whatever it might be. There's just huge benefits, and so helping to try and get to grips with all of that is what I like to think we can try and bring.
Fascinating and fab. Brilliant. Thank you. Hi. So if you could just start by saying who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I'm Krista Hammond, and I work for the Met Office, and I'm part of the Space Weather Programme there. I'm an account manager, so I work in stakeholder relationship management.
So what do you find the most exciting part of what you do?
I find space weather just inherently interesting. So if anyone doesn't know, space weather is looking at conditions on the sun and how that impacts us here on Earth. It's how it interacts with the upper atmosphere and the Earth environment. And before I started this, I was actually an operational forecaster, a meteorologist, and I've just had to learn so much about space, space weather, space industry. And coming to something like this is super helpful because it gives me such an understanding about the whole diverse range of areas of research and technology and innovation that there is in the space sector. And that in itself is just exciting, just seeing how everything is going, seeing the direction that everything's taking.
Did you fall into the space side from meteorology or...?
Yeah, I almost came into this by accident. So I trained with the Met Office as a meteorologist, and I worked in a variety of roles. So the Met Office is best known for public weather forecasts, but we also do things like forecasts for aviation, for shipping, for emergency services. And back in 2014, we started doing space weather forecasting as well. And I had not heard of space weather before we started forecasting it, but it is fascinating. So essentially, I saw that we were forecasting for space weather, thought I wanted to be involved in that, absolutely loved it, and then moved away from that operational side of things, the shift work, and into the relationship management. Now I'm super privileged that I get to speak to some of the smartest minds in the UK who are at the absolute forefront of the science, and how I can work with them to sort of pick that science, and then how we can actually apply that into operations, into forecasting, so that our forecasts then make a real difference to the UK.
Brilliant. Well, speaking of forecasting, what's the most exciting thing we've got to look forward to in the future?
That is a very good question. It's been such an exciting couple of years because we're at now solar maximum, so the sun's at the height, peak of its activity. And we've seen some significant space weather events within the last 18 months or so. So we saw just a couple of weeks ago the largest solar radiation storm in 20 years. We saw a geomagnetic storm last year, which was a G5, the highest on the scale. But I don't think we've seen the biggest space weather event of this solar cycle yet. So I reckon that's a bold claim, isn't it? I reckon in the next couple of years, we'll see more of the same. And I think this is going to continue in the future. And the big thing is, even if we don't get those real worst case scenario storms, even these sort of lower magnitude storms are starting to impact on the systems that we rely on every day for our technology. So I think the coming years are going to be super interesting in terms of space weather.
Wow, brilliant. Thank you. That was really interesting to hear about space weather and what goes into that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Many thanks to Vicky Hall and Anna Perdue from RAL Space for inviting Jotcast to attend the Appleton Space Conference. Our interview with Jane Hurley on research at RAL will feature in a later episode, so stay tuned.
Thank you to Jonathan Tennyson and Will McGann for the interviews. The audio editors were Jamie Inslee, Louisa Mason, and Thea Hawkswell. The show editor was Alex Walls. The show lead was Louisa Mason. The producer was Lily Correa Magnus. Until next time,
Jot on.